Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Marianne Combs. Over the weekend, a construction crew began tearing down a controversial art installation in the newly expanded Minneapolis Sculpture Garden. The work, Scaffold, by artist Sam Durant, was meant to be a commentary on capital punishment, referencing gallows used in seven hangings throughout American history. But the work drew sharp criticism when it came to light that one of the gallows referenced came from the execution of 38 Dakota men in Mankato in 1862. The decision to dismantle the structure and burn its pieces was reached after days of negotiation among Dakota elders, the Walker Art Center, the Minneapolis Park Board, and the artist. It's just the most recent controversy over how Dakota history and culture is being portrayed in our state. Last year, the renovation of the state capitol reignited a conversation over two large paintings that Minnesota tribes find offensive and asked to be removed. Instead, they've been relocated to less prominent rooms. And then there's Fort Snelling. The historical site just received $4 million in bonding bill money to help design a new visitor center. Yet there are major conflicts in the community over just what history it should tell. So what is at the heart of all of these conversations? And how best to deal with similar situations moving forward. I'm joined this hour by three guests. Shelley Buck is the Tribal Council President for the Prairie Island Indian Community. Shelley, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Gwen Westerman is a professor at the Minnesota State University Mankato and is the author of Minnesota Makoche, The Land of the Dakota. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Joe, joining me here in studio is Joe Horsecapture, the director of American Indian Initiatives at the Minnesota Historical Society. He also served for many years as a curator of Native American art at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Joe, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Shelley Buck, first to you. In casual conversation, I've heard people ask, well, why is there suddenly all this controversy over art that's been hanging on walls for years or over the names of our lakes? Are these new conversations?
No, they're not new conversations. These conversations have been going on for quite a while, but no one's actually ever listened to us. So now's our chance to really change the way that the state and our children in the state are taught the true history of this state.
What has changed? You say nobody was listening before. What do you think's changed?
We now have the ability to have a bigger voice. Unfortunately, in the past, we didn't have the money as a people to be heard. No one really cared to listen to us, and we didn't have the resources to hire people to help us with such things like the PR groups and lobbyists and people like that. But now that we have some resources coming in, we're able to afford people like that, and now it's our chance to get our voices out there.
Do you think the climate, the sort of the public reception to the ideas have changed at all over the years?
I think it has, and especially after this last election, I think it's brought a lot of things to the surface for people, and it's re-energized even the youngest people. I know my daughters are so into the political world now and actually looking at things differently and asking more questions. And if that's just my children doing that, I can imagine children all over the place are doing that.
Joe Horsecapture, you worked as an art curator for many years before joining the Minnesota Historical Society. And for many people, the controversy over the paintings at the Capitol and the tearing down of the scaffold at the Walker smacks censorship. They've said as much. What do you say to them in response?
Well, regarding the scaffold, I mean, you know, censorship is when the artist is forced to take the piece down. During the conversations, is my understanding, he realized that his work was disturbing Dakota people. And he felt that with working with the Walker and the group that it needed to come down.
Mm-hmm. And to those people who say, well, does this mean now we need to get community approval before any piece of work goes up?
I don't like the idea of saying approval. So with this Walker issue, mm-hmm. I think there's sort of a number of different layers where things probably could have gone better. One of them is working with the community. And as we sort of look at the what's happening at the Capitol, with the Capitol paintings, what's happening with the Walker situation, basically what it comes down to is the opportunity for Native people to tell their own stories.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at the scaffold issue, that certainly was clear. An artist should work with the community, or even hire a Native artist, hire a Dakota person to create something that reflects their own. Because as you know, Minnesota is a diverse place. We have many, many voices. For such a long time, I think the Minnesota public has only heard one voice. And as things start to change, it's an opportunity to hear multiple voices, because the history of Minnesota is very complex.
We're talking this hour about public art and culture, and especially in recent instances in which it has neglected or misportrayed Native American history here in Minnesota, and how, what needs to be done about it? What are best practices moving forward? You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. Or email us at talk@nprnews.org. Gwen Westerman, the fact that we're having all these very public conversations, that the city of Minneapolis has replaced Columbus Day with Indigenous Peoples Day, and that the Minneapolis Park Board has voted to change the name of Lake Calhoun back to its original name, does this feel like progress?
It is progress. There has been a lot of groundwork laid down ahead of all of these things that are happening right now. But to have a Dakota presence and Dakota voices in public conversation, I think, is an important aspect of a new collaboration and cooperation that's developing.
And for you, in looking at this, how important, or how, when you compare side by side these instances of progress where it seems like things are moving forward with then an incident in which a piece of public work goes up that doesn't seem to have considered the Dakota culture when it was put in place. Do you feel a sense of we're moving forward, or we're moving forward and then taking two steps back?
Well, I think in terms of Native peoples in this state and in this country, it's always been one step forward, two steps back. But the Walker issue is from outside of Minnesota. This artist is not from Minnesota, has admitted that he didn't do enough background work before he created the piece to fully understand our history. So I think this is different than the kinds of work that is being done in the state with our Dakota people and our Dakota communities and our Ojibwe relatives as well.
Joe Horsecapture mentioned earlier, he was saying how, you know, we have it, we've been hearing from one voice predominantly, and we have a plurality of voices here as we become increasingly diverse. What do you see as, you know, in talking to people who are not Native American, what are we all missing out on by not getting the full story around Dakota history?
Anytime we get just one side, one version of history, we're not getting the full picture, because there are multiple experiences, multiple responses to historical events, and the more stories we know, the fuller picture we have of who we are as people in the state of Minnesota and across the country.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel, in terms of the reasons why we keep on having these similar conversations, where do you find the fault, or what's missing so that we're not moving forward in understanding the cultural history and the nuances of it?
We have more than 150 years of state history to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And for Dakota people and Indigenous people in this region, it goes hundreds and thousands of years beyond that. So when we continue to teach and present the same information over and over again, that presents only one side of the story, then it's going to take us a long time to reach everybody. And we may not reach everybody, but there are people today who say to me, who grew up in Mankato, who say to me, I never knew what happened in Mankato.
Mm.
So people are willing to listen most of the time, and there's a lot of learning to be done as more and more stories about our experiences and about our history come to a broader public view.
Shelley Buck, when you deal with this sort of seeming ignorance on a part of many people in terms of being aware of Native American history here in Minnesota, what do you think needs to change to create a more educated and sensitive, mindful public when it comes to issues around Native American culture?
I think to help the entire state, I think it would be best to start with the kids. Kids are our future, and that's the way we think in our culture. And in teaching those kids the correct part of history that's kind of glossed over or romanticized needs to change. I know here in Red Wing, where the majority of our kids who live on the reservation go, they ask us to come in and talk about the culture, talk about things that are going on. And I know when my daughter was younger and she went to Fort Snelling for a field trip, they didn't really talk about it being a concentration camp for her people. They talked about how churning butter and how to churn butter, taught them how to do that because that was more acceptable to teach our children than what truly happened to individuals back in the day. And I think once everyone understands the history of how people were taught here, maybe they can start to understand why some of our people act the way they act and are the way they are.
Talking about let's go talk about the Capitol art for a moment. There were two paintings, and Shelley, you wrote an editorial asking for them to be taken down, and instead it was decided that to have them move to less populated or frequented rooms at the Capitol. How does that decision sit with you?
That decision to leave those paintings in the Capitol, just move to a different area, does not sit very well with me. They asked for the input of the surrounding tribes, and we all were in agreement that these paintings need to be taken down, and they didn't listen to any of us. We felt like it was pretty much just they were just checking off that box that they spoke with us and they were going to move on. It's sad because the Capitol is supposed to be the people's place, the people's house, and it's not for our children when they go there. When our children go there for field trips, it doesn't feel like the people's house.
Hmm. Gwen Westerman, you were on that committee. What was that experience like?
It was a difficult experience. I'm not a politician, and I don't fully understand the way politics in this state work. I see it in operation, but there were multiple entities represented on that committee, and it was halfway through the year and a half long process where I finally had a chance to speak about the five works of art in the state capitol that depict Dakota history. And one of those five also depicts Ojibwe history.
Mm-hmm.
And there was tremendous opposition to anything that we had to say as Dakota people. Tony Troyer was there as the representative for the Ojibwe people, and it was a difficult process. So our recommendations as the subcommittee for the historic art were to remove those paintings and to remove the Civil War painting that depicts the battle at Killdeer Mountain,
mm-hmm.
The Anton or the Gog painting, Attack on New Ulm, and we also knew that there had to be a way to provide more context. And like Shelley was saying, it's, you know, we have to start with children, because there are a lot of school kids who come through the state capitol and would see those paintings and have no idea what they meant. And, you know, just in a 2-minute walk around, and then they're out again. So we wanted the paintings removed. And I guess I want to push back a little bit on this issue of instead the paintings were moved to another place within the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
That was a compromise to get them out of the governor's reception room. And they're now going to be on the third floor in a larger room, and there's going to be some extensive interpretation and discussion about those two paintings and why they're problematic for Dakota communities in this state and in this region, so that people will understand why they affect us and why we respond to them in the ways that we do. There will be hopefully an opportunity for Native artists to respond to those two paintings, so that there's a conversation and more context developed for what those mean to us as Dakota people. And the governor insisted that the committee speak to all of the 11 communities in the state of Minnesota, and their comments and responses were brought back to the subcommittee, and we took those into significant consideration, and our response was to remove those paintings. But there was there was significant opposition, and this was a compromise. And I think in the interim, in terms of helping teach a fuller history, not the romanticized version, as Shelley pointed out, is important. And this is one step forward for us to be able to tell that fuller history about those two specific paintings especially.
Does that feel like a good compromise?
I don't want to put it into binaries, good and bad, right and wrong. I would rather say that this is progress. Those two paintings are now out of a place of prominence.
The governor's reception hall.
The governor's reception room. They have been removed from there, and they're on the third floor. And I don't know if you've been up to the third floor yet.
No.
But when you walk into the renovated area, the first thing you see is the Why Treaties Matter exhibit in the two main hallways of the third floor meeting areas. In the meeting area on the left is an installation of photographs of Muslim immigrant citizens in the state of Minnesota. Then there's the long room where the two paintings will be installed. And then there's a gallery on the other side that when I saw it earlier in the spring, that includes photographs of the Hmong community gardens. So there is more openness to talking about or displaying who we are as the citizens of Minnesota, and it's progress, it's movement out of the governor's reception room into an area where more people will be able to see it and talk about it and learn about it among all these other exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's progress.
Yeah. We're talking this hour about works of public art, public memorials and structures, everything from the Walker's recent scaffold, which is in the process of being taken down now, to Fort Snelling as it stands as an educating monument to Minnesota history and artwork at the Capitol, and the controversies that arise around which history we're telling, whose version of history, and particularly in ways that these neglect or misconstrue Native American history and culture, particularly Dakota and Ojibwe history and culture. If you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call with your question or comment at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 1-800-242-2828, or you can email us at talk@mprnews.org. Let's go to the phones. We've got James on the line in St. Paul. James, welcome to the conversation.
Hi.
Hi.
First, I want to preface what I'm going to say with to let you know that my family and I were just very shy, according to the government, of being members in another tribe. We have relatives who grew up on the reservation. We visited them. So we're very sensitive to many of these issues. But with specific to that sculpture of the that was taken down, I have some real problems with the idea that somehow that story is only belongs to the Lakota, because there were two sides involved, and the Lakota have a story of their point of view to tell, and there's a European point of view to tell, and they are both nobody gets to belong or own that story. And what's more, you know, we need to see the horror of the bad things that happened so we don't repeat them, rather than shut down conversation.
Right, James. Okay. Thanks. I get your point of view there. And I think it's what you're trying to get at is that, you know, there are different sides to history. The European side of history is the one that's dominated culture. And oftentimes it's the culture that dominates that gets to tell history, that gets to share its own version of history. What is the benefit to saying, no, that's actually more nuanced than that, Joe Horse Capture, that there isn't just one version of history?
Well, there is multiple versions of history. And I think, and of course, I can't speak for the Dakota community. I'm not Dakota. But what I can speak to is what I've learned and also within my experience. And particularly with this sculpture, I mean, there is the work in that history is phenomenally painful to the Dakota people. And not only for many Dakota people is this work offensive just by the subject, but also the main intent was to have people walk on it and have a being a playground. So it's, and I understand the perspective as multiple points of history, but if the history needs to be told, I think it would be best beneficial for a member of that community to be able to tell that history.
Mm-hmm. Gwen Westerman, I think you've dealt a lot with this in your writing a book that details Dakota history here in Minnesota. And do you come across this a lot where people are simply don't understand the importance of telling a different version of history that's not just centered around their own cultural experience?
Yes, it's fairly common. And I made a presentation in New Ulm about 5 years ago in August. And when they first asked me to come, I didn't want to go. But I decided to go. And what I talked about that day was the importance of telling our stories as Dakota people, which is a hard thing to do in New Ulm. Mm. And the hall was filled. But I also told them that we could walk outside on the sidewalk and pick a random person and ask them about what happened in August of 1862 in that place. And probably 8 or 9 times out of 10, that random person on the street would not know. But we are personally invested in this history because it's about us. And I think that's true also of any type of regional history when you have a personal stake in it, especially for us as Dakota people, to have been continually portrayed as savages and perpetrators of violence. Even in the comments just in the last week, somebody said the war started because 4 Dakota men killed some settlers. It's like, no, that's not the start of the war. That's not the cause of the war. So to have a superficial understanding of the history, I think, is commonplace. And that's why I said earlier, and that's, you know, why I want to support Shelley's point about the more we can educate younger people about this and get a fuller story into the educational process, we'll be able to start remedying this kind of myopic vision of what this history is all about.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about Fort Snelling in particular. And in order to do that, I've asked Melanie Adams to join us. She's with the Minnesota Historical Societies. She's the Senior Director for Guest Experiences and Educational Services. Melanie, thank you for joining the conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it feels like with Fort Snelling, we have a particularly intense situation. You know, you've just gotten bonding money to help design a new visitor center. But there are conflicting opinions about what sort of history do we tell at Fort Snelling. And some people say, you know, it's always been about military history. Other people say that's, you know, it's a very narrow view of Minnesota history and that it needs to be more inclusive of Dakota culture and history. What do you do in terms of, you know, and how, where are you of how the way Fort Snelling is presented to the public influences our own perceptions of Minnesota history moving forward?
Great. Well, I think you might have been the one who said it in terms of history is not binary. There are not two sides to every story, but I think a lot of your panelists have really expressed a lot of what we're doing at Fort Snelling in terms of making sure the diverse voices are heard throughout the narratives we present. The military history at Fort Snelling at Bedote is such a small speck in time in terms of the narratives that have happened throughout that space for the last 10,000 years. And I wholly agree with the panelists who said that it's really important that children see themselves in history. They see kind of the wide aspects of history, and they don't only see it from a dominant culture point of view. Mm-hmm. And so I think the narratives that we are telling at Fort Snelling are showing a more expansive view of history. And it's not taking away from the military history, but it really is adding to and creating a more complete history. History at Fort Snelling did not start when the fort was built. And so I think it's really important for people to know that. And by really providing that opportunity, not only for children, but for adults as well, we're telling a more complete story of Minnesota history.
Yeah. And how do you respond to people who push back and say, but wait, this is the history. This is the real history. This, you know, look over here. This is the history that we all know. You can't change that. You're rewriting history.
Right. And that is a common argument. And I don't think you would say you were rewriting science or you're rewriting other areas or other disciplines. History changes as new information becomes available. We do not teach Columbus discovered America anymore. I mean, I think there are certain aspects of history that we've learned that they are more nuanced, I think, as one of the panelists said. And so it's really important. We cannot teach the same history at Fort Snelling from 1976 that we're teaching now. I think it was Dr. Westerman made a great comment about students and kids are asking a lot of questions. They're asking very different questions than they asked 10, 20 years ago. And it's really important that we as educators, we as a historic site, really present them with a broader range of stories and not just the singular narrative of the dominant culture.
You know, this past weekend, the construction crew has been dismantling the scaffold structure, and everybody agreed, you know what, this is not a good thing for our community, and it's being taken down, and it's going to later be burned. Some argue that the fort should be dismantled, that because of what it stands for, and it's being a monument to military might. Can you ever envision a day where the Minnesota Historical Society agreed that, you know what, let's take this down. This no longer represents something that we want to put out to our community.
I think what we as the Minnesota Historical Society really want to make sure that we're doing at not only Fort Snelling, but at all of our sites, is really telling a more expansive view of history. And so I think it's really important for us to be able to say that this is not only military history, but this really involves the history of more people within our community. And so how can we tell that story so everyone feels welcome in the space? It's not just a singular narrative that's being told. Mm-hmm. So how do we expand upon that?
Mm-hmm. Melanie Adams, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye.
We're talking this hour about Native American history and culture and how it has been mistold or neglected in certain aspects of our public art and culture, how the conversation is changing around that. And after the news, we're going to get back to talking about best practices moving forward. How does this happen as we look ahead to future conversations? How should this be done in a way that's respectful moving forward? We're going to get to that conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to join us with your question or comment, you can reach us at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828 or email us at talk@mprnews.org. We'll be back in just a moment with that conversation. First, it's a time for a news head update with Stephen John. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Marianne. A disgruntled former employee opened fire this morning inside a Florida awning manufacturer, killing five workers before turning the gun on himself. The Orange County Sheriff described the shooter as a 45-year-old man who had been fired in April and had been previously accused of assaulting a coworker. The attacker was not believed to be a member of any type of subversive or terrorist organization. British counterterrorism investigators have searched two homes and detained a number of people in the investigation into a van and knife attack in the heart of London. Seven people were killed, dozens were injured, many of them critically. President Trump is once again criticizing London Mayor Sadiq Khan. On Twitter this morning, the president said Khan had offered a, quote, pathetic excuse for an earlier statement saying Londoners had no reason to be alarmed. Trump on Sunday accused Khan of telling people not to be alarmed over the terrorist attack. The mayor was actually telling people not to be alarmed by the city's increased police presence. The judge in Bill Cosby's sexual assault trial has given the jury an hour of instructions, reminding them not to glance at news updates on their cell phones. The 79-year-old Cosby is accused of giving a Temple University employee drugs and then sexually assaulting her. The 12-member jury, which was selected from the Pittsburgh area, includes seven men and five women, along with six alternates, for the trial in suburban Philadelphia. Opening statements are expected today in the trial of a Minnesota police officer charged in the Philando Castile shooting. Jury selection last week produced a pool of 23 potential jurors. That number was expected to be whittled down today to 15. St. Anthony police officer Geronimo Yanez is charged with manslaughter in the fatal shooting of Castile during a traffic stop last summer. Sunny skies for Minnesota today. Seasonable temperatures 68 now in the Twin Cities. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
On Morning Edition, Kathy Werzer asks the questions that need to be answered.
Should there be peremptory challenges?
Many lawyers will say that they depend on peremptory challenges.
Tune in weekdays from 4 to 9 on Minnesota Public Radio News.
Coming up at noon, a conversation about race and America featuring Eddie Gloud Jr. of Princeton University. Gloud is the author of Democracy in Black, How Race Still Enslaves the American Soul. It's our Thread Book Hour. That's coming up at noon.
Programming is supported by Comcast Business, offering fiber-rich Ethernet solutions, high-speed internet phone and video services. Comcast is dedicated to helping build Twin Cities businesses, connect communities, and empower partnerships. ComcastBusiness.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Tom Weber this week. And this hour, we're talking about how we portray Native American history and culture here in the Twin Cities, in Minnesota. And we've had recent situations, well, not just recent situations, but we've had several situations in recent history, whether it's the Walker scaffold, artwork at the state capitol, the renovation of Fort Snelling, which has brought up new questions about how we share our history. And I'm joined this hour by Gwen Westerman, who's a Dakota educator, writer, and artist, and Joe Horsecapture, who's the director of American Indian Initiatives at the Minnesota Historical Society. Gwen Westerman, we were talking before the break about Fort Snelling, and I'm curious, in your ideal view, what would you see at Fort Snelling? What would be sort of what would people learn about Dakota culture there?
In my ideal view, mm-hmm. There would be a dedicated place for telling Dakota history and the history of Indigenous peoples in this, what is now the state of Minnesota. But, you know, there are so many things that have happened there. and so many people who have come through that place that we have to make room for everyone's stories. Mm. You know, we know as Indigenous people, as Dakota people, what it's like to have our history erased. And so from my perspective, I don't want to be complicit in erasing someone else's history.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of stories to be told there. Last summer, I met with Japanese American incarcerees at Tule Lake in Northern California to commemorate their experiences there. And some of them had fathers and grandfathers who were Japanese language experts and teachers at Fort Snelling.
Hmm.
When I found my mother's father's discharge papers from the Army from World War II, he had gone through the enlistment process at Fort Snelling. And I did not know that until I saw his discharge papers. So there's so many layers to this history, and there's so many opportunities, like Melanie said, to tell this diverse history that in an ideal space, from my perspective, all of those stories would have a place.
Mm. Shelley Buck, you're president of the Prairie Island Indian Community, and you were talking earlier, we heard from a caller earlier who was implying, well, the people who win history get to rewrite history, which seems to imply a certain level of white supremacy. I mean, is that what we're dealing with in terms of the history here? Are we dealing with the legacy of white supremacy dictating the history we learn?
Well, I don't really want to label it that. I don't want to fight hate with hate.
Mm.
I would like to look at it that it's just time that we're able to have a voice and that we're able to tell our side of the story and that people are taught our side of the story. There's two sides to every story. And up till now, we've only heard one side, and it's time we start hearing the other side and letting people decide on their own, based off the two sides they hear, what parts they're going to believe.
Mm-hmm. So expand on that a little bit more for me, if you would.
Well, like I said, with the school systems, I really think it's time that our school children in the state, their history classes are done differently, that they're taught when they get to that section of the Ojibwe and the Dakota people, that those parts are done in correlation with the surrounding tribes and the history that has been passed down through generations from within the tribe. I think it's time that those stories are being heard within the schools. And like I said before, everything starts with the children. The children are our future.
Mm, got it. Joe Horsecapture, as director of American Indian Initiatives at the Minnesota Historical Society, how are you working moving forward in work, you know, in projects like Fort Snelling and others? How are you trying to be more mindful of Dakota communities and Ojibwe communities as you work on projects that involve telling the history of Minnesota?
One of our objectives in our department, there's three of us. There's myself, there's Kate Bean, who is Dakota, Maddie Harper, who is Ojibwe. Both of them work with communities. Specifically for Fort Snelling, we've been fortunate enough to work with a group called the Dakota Community Council, and they have been guiding us as we sort of move down with Fort Snelling, and we recently signed a partnership agreement with them. And so many museums often work together, well, not often enough, work with Native communities in a sense of consultation or advising. What was important is that we work with them within a partnership context. So what that means, particularly with the Fort Snelling at Bedote project, is they have a very strong presence on how that is interpreted, using Dakota language when we can, even with the landscape. Planting Native flowers, ensuring that there's cultural space for them, ensuring that there's multiple voices being told at the fort. So as we sort of move forward with projects, we ensure that we work with a large community base, because much like with many Native communities, there necessarily isn't one voice or another voice over here, another voice over there. There's multiple voices. And putting together a community council, what it does is ensures that we can have as many voices as we reasonably can from multiple points of view.
Thanks. So, and I'd also like to reference your work back working with the Minneapolis Institute of Art, because I remember reporting on work that you did there as a curator. And the work you did with specifically with Native American art had a different certain things that you brought to bear as a Native American, as a member of a tribe, that, to say that you were very respectful. You looked at, okay, how do we position these works of art? If we bring in one work of art, we don't want it to actually be within sight of another work of art, that we had, you actually draped one piece while you brought in another piece. That seems like a whole different level from what we're talking about here. Is that the end goal, that we have that level of cultural competency when we're dealing with these works of art or in telling these histories throughout?
I think the end goal is to ensure that Native people work in institutions where they're in positions where they can tell the stories of their people, mm-hmm. where they can work with other Native people, they can have influence. To me, that's the end goal.
Mm-hmm.
As for where we stand today, there's slowly Native Americans are starting to enter the museum field. It's been a slow boat to get there. But some museums are slowly starting to get it, and understanding that voice is important. It's not only important because respect for the works of art themselves, for the objects, I guess one would say, but also to ensure that their visitor is getting multiple points of view. And if you don't, then you start running into issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also with many Native people, and myself included, there is certain objects that radiate spiritual power. And it's very important to respect that.
Mm-hmm. Gwen Westerman, we've been talking about education, amongst other things. You are an educator. What are the barriers to getting a better education system in place in terms of teaching Native American history to kids throughout the school system, so that when they take a class from you, that's not their first experience with it?
I have the utmost respect for our citizens who choose to go into a life of service as public school teachers. The demands on them are incredibly wide-ranging, and the sacrifices that they make to help their students extends beyond the classroom. They have to follow state standards. Fortunately for us in the state of Minnesota, beginning in 2008, the state standards for all of the content areas were updated to say that in some way, shape, or form, according to content, there should be contributions of American Indians or Native Americans, especially Dakota and Ojibwe peoples, in the content of these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great, but our teachers in Minnesota are still hungry for resources, and the more resources we can provide them through the Indian Education offices that have connections with our own local tribal communities, the better off they're going to be. But like Joe said, it's a slow boat to publishing, to curriculum development, to children's picture books, young adult fiction, and even more advanced types of art and literature and history and political science and religion and topics that, well, I should take religion out. That's not part of the state standards.
Mm-hmm.
But that are presented by Indigenous authors or Indigenous perspectives. So it's a slow boat, but it's turning.
Mm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Nicole on the line in Moorhead. Nicole, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just thought, in the spirit of, working towards compromise and progress, and also as a way to embrace Native American culture, in Minnesota, our greater culture, if it would be, if there is a possibility of commissioning a Native artist to create a piece of art to display in the Capitol building or another prominent spot.
Okay. That's a good question.
Can I maybe answer,
Shelley,
or respond to that?
Please.
Yeah. I was had the privilege to be part of the meetings with the Dakota elders and the Walker Art Center, as well as the artist himself. And that was one of the things the elders wanted to ask for, was that the Walker Art Center commission either a Native artist or artists to work together in collaboration to create a structure that could replace the scaffold piece, and also work with them on getting more Native cultured items within the center itself. So they were very receptive to that. However, we have not had a meeting with the Walker Art Center people. The Four Dakota tribes have not. They did respond to us or reach out to us after their meetings with the elders to request that meeting. So hopefully that dialogue has started. But if that dialogue had been started at the beginning, none of this would have happened.
Yeah. And Shelley, is that the frustration that you have people on one side of the conversation, you're saying, well, this is just the beginning of the conversation, and you feel like you've been having this conversation over and over and over again?
Exactly. It's what happens. The Four Dakota communities, they're never reached out to. People say that they don't know how to get in touch with anybody. All you have to do is go on the website to the four different Dakota communities' websites to see the contact information and set up meetings with us. We're always willing to meet with people, especially when it's going to help get our story out there.
So in terms of having this conversation over and over again, what really needs to change, Gwen Westerman?
We have to be patient. In terms of understanding that not everyone has heard our positions, has not heard our history, and be willing to continue to tell our story and to put our narrative up front and center for people to access. But, you know, there are always going to be those people who don't want to hear it. And we have to acknowledge that as well, and work with the people who are willing to listen. And, you know, and I said in a number of different venues over the last week that this issue with the scaffold is on the Walker. It was their decision to allow that to be installed, knowing full well that it was in the middle of our Dakota homeland, and it's up to them to fix it in consultation with our Dakota communities. But we have to keep moving forward. We have to keep telling our stories. We have to continue to work with people who are making changes in public education and keep working hard, but also recognize that there are some people we will never reach, and that's okay.
Shelley Buck, you've been talking, as you mentioned, you've been involved in these conversations with the Dakota Tribal Elders and the Walker. Where do things now stand with the remains of the structure? Is it still going to be moved to Fort Snelling? What happens next?
As far as I know, when I left the meetings, it was going to be dismantled, and then they were going to be removed to Fort Snelling for another ceremony. I believe the elders wanted to do a burning. But there again, the four Dakota communities have not been a part of that conversation, except for I was at one of those meetings, as well as one of the other leaders from, I believe it was Lower Sioux, or I'm sorry, Upper Sioux. But, you know, we've never been in contact with the Walker Art Center to discuss those items. So currently it's going to be going to Fort Snelling, and I believe there's going to be a ceremony with burning, but I don't have any more details on that.
Mm-hmm. And there are many people who have been asking why the need to destroy the scaffold. Can you explain the importance of that?
The scaffold is a symbol of probably the most devastating event that has ever happened to the Dakota people in this state. It's a pain that still affects my people to this day. It's a generational pain that hasn't stopped. And with the building of that scaffold, it brought all that pain and emotion back to the forefront, and it's just so detrimental. To this day, it's still the largest mass execution ordered by the U.S. government on U.S. soil. That's just phenomenal that it happened to my people, and it's tragic, it's sad. A good portion of the people in this state don't even know about the hanging of the 38+2, and I think that needs to be told. That story needs to be told. People need to understand why this structure was such a tremendous thing for our people to see, and it just needs to get told. The story needs to get out there. People need to understand. They need to be sympathetic.
Yes. And Shelley, thanks for that. And also, I should note that we do have a piece up on our website at NPR News that actually details some of that history and why it has provoked such a strong reaction and people seeing it. And Joe Horsecapture, you know, Shelley Buck mentioned some resources and said, look, you know, the tribes are relatively easy to contact. What other resources are there out there for people who are perhaps, you know, cultural institutions who are looking to engage in work that deals with Native American history or that brushes up against some of these issues? Who should they talk to?
Well, we have a lot of resources on our at the Minnesota Historical Society's website. As Shelley mentioned, there's strong voices out in the Dakota community. They can reach out to those. And specifically, as we sort of double back with the sculpture, I think one of the things also is important is there are several exiled Dakota communities. And as this process of what to do with the sculpture sort of moves forward, one of the things that I think is important to consider is to sort of slow the process down. Because clearly, as this has started to develop, they really necessarily haven't gotten as many community voices as maybe would be best. So if one would slow the process down, work with the Dakota people here in the Twin Cities, in the four communities here in the state, as well as those out of state, and slow it down and build a consensus on how to move forward.
Joe Horsecapture, thank you so very much. I'm afraid that's all the time we have this hour, but I want to thank all of you for taking the time to speak with us today. We've been joined by Joe Horsecapture. He's the Director of American India Initiatives at the Minnesota Historical Society. Joe, thanks so much for being here today.
It was a pleasure.
Gwen Westerman, she's a Dakota educator, writer, and artist. Gwen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Shelley Buck is the president of the Prairie Island Indian Community. Shelley Buck, thanks so much for being a part of this conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.